ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Wedding movies come in just about all shapes and sizes. One thing they're all going to do, though, is make you squirm. A wedding is a very public display of love that also has material consequences, of course. It's about the start of a financial union, normally, and it's also about the coming together of two families. But in a wedding movie, something always threatens to undermine this very public display, catastrophically. Whether that's the prospective in-laws who hate each other, or a best friend who can't let go, or either the bride or groom getting cold feet. This Week in Cinemas, an excellent new black comedy called The Drama is about someone getting very, very cold feet. And what makes it more interesting than usual is that this forces us to consider a set of what I think are some very contemporary moral issues.
Emma, true love is complicated.
Sorry, I'm just trying to do your stupid joke thing.
It's about acceptance, radical acceptance.
Why are you acting like you've never done anything bad?
What the fuck was that?
I don't know. That's some drama. It's very funny.
Hello, this is The Screen Show on ABC Radio National, ABC Listen, or your podcast provider of choice. I'm Jason DeRosso. The Drama stars Zendaya and Robert Pattinson as the bride and groom-to-be. And as of recording this show, the world is under a strict critics embargo, so I can't tell what other reviewers have revealed about this plot. But as you'll hear in my interview with director Christopher Borgli, this is a movie that is a tricky one to review, so I'm going to err on the side of caution when it comes to spoilers. I will tell you, though, that the plot of The Drama revolves around a hypothetical. What if the person you love revealed to you a secret from their past that made you see them in a completely different light? In such a different light that they ceased to be the person you fell in love with. And what if that thing from their past was just a thought or an intention to do something terrible, but it was never acted upon? I won't tell you anymore. Maybe I've said too much, but The Drama asks a profound question about forgiveness and redemption, the place of it in modern society, I think. And it asks if we're too ready to demonize people for who they once were or what they once thought. Pattinson and Zendaya are both terrific in this movie in two performances that have them jump through various emotional hoops: anger, sadness, fear. And by the end of it, Pattinson really does look like he needs some serious professional help. Borgli hails from Norway. His previous features, Sick of Myself and Dream Scenario, were both black comedies. The first was about a health influencer. The second was about a narcissistic professor played by Nick Cage. The Drama sees Borgli develop further into a very perceptive satirist. This is a film that you could imagine Lars von Trier might have once made, and it will make you squirm in the best possible way. Christopher Borgli is coming up.
Am I sensing some nerves? Remember, you know each other really well.
You have to stop thinking about it.
Can I just say stop thinking?
So you are thinking about it.
How the fuck's it? I am thinking about it now.
How can you even trust her?
You're being incredibly hypocritical.
I never said he was mentally disabled.
Yes, you did. You said he was slow.
Christopher Borgli, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, I don't know how much to reveal about the central premise and this devastating revelation that happens very early on in the film. So I'll let you decide what you want to tell me. But I want to start by talking about this idea of what I would call a mind crime, even though it's perhaps more than that, this idea that the film really hinges on this admission to, I think, a mind crime more than anything else. There's maybe a little bit more in it. Where does this idea come from?
Well, you're already like kind of
spoiling too much, in my opinion. But I'm also of the mindset of you should not read anything and know absolutely nothing before going in. So it is kind of weird doing these interviews talking about the movie before the movie comes out, because I kind of want to say absolutely nothing, but the idea came from experiencing, you know, love so intense that I was questioning, where would I draw the line? What would make me break the spell of love? And that's something that this movie explores.
I think you found a fantastic couple of actors to play these betrothed, these engaged young people. And Zendaya especially is wonderful, because in her screen presence, you do fall in love with her. And of course, Pattinson is this renowned kind of super hunk, but he has always chooses these very interesting characters, right? So they're both very beautiful people that as an audience, you feel you want to fall in love with yourself. So you can understand why they're in love. So it's this wonderful thing when suddenly that love is undermined, I guess. Tell me about casting them.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. I do want the audience to feel what the characters are feeling, this sort of whirlwind and chaos of, you know, getting to know someone, falling in love with someone, and then having to reckon with maybe uncomfortable truths about these people that tests the sort of charm and appreciation that is built in the beginning of the movie. And I think these two people just have so much natural charisma and such like camera presence and are such lovable people in real life and on camera that it's like impossible not to like them.
How did you cast them? Did you always have them in mind, or did you go through various ideas for different pairings?
It is kind of a crazy one for me, because as soon as the script was done, the studio, A24, they got on board. The script was existing sort of behind the scenes within, you know, the studio, and some agents had it. And we hadn't really gone out to casting yet. And then Zendaya's team found it and they reached out to us first. So this has never happened. And of course, when I got that phone call, it was a very easy decision. And Rob came to one of the screenings of Dream Scenario, my previous movie. We had a chat after the movie and we met for dinner. And he was kind of nudging me and asking if, you know, do you have a part for me? Are you working on anything? And, you know, this character is a British man of a certain age. It's like kind of perfectly written for him, and having him already be interested, that was another no-brainer.
Look, the two films of yours I've seen before this, you mentioned one of them, their Dream Scenario, in which Nick Cage plays quite a narcissistic academic, and Sick of Myself is about a young woman who actively tries to become, well, very famous and infamous, actually, via a series of medical mishaps, let's put it that way. But as a filmmaker, I find that you're really great at observing themes of social capital, and your films have this focus on the reputational. And even if they're not really necessarily about social media or online, and this film certainly is not about that, all the films seem to really have found the temperature of the room at the moment in the culture, in that they're not necessarily about online culture. This film certainly isn't, but they seem to be infected by this hypersensitivity about reputation and personal branding that I think is a characteristic of today's culture, and because of, I think, online culture especially. Do you think social media has had an influence on you and on this focus that you seem so, you seem to return to again and again, this focus on reputations and the damage to reputations and personal branding?
Yeah, I mean, both of my previous features were sort of, I was overlapping the two scripts when I was writing them. So they both, I guess, came from a similar mindset. It was definitely on my mind more, the sort of the way that the internet and our identity gets infused by the internet and the discrepancies between sort of our persona and person, and how the internet has like sort of pushed us and created a pressure on personal branding. And they're both, you know, in a way, like Sick of Myself and Dream Scenario, both are a little bit like horror movies about personal branding. And I really wanted to, I'm more like, I felt, okay, I've said my piece. And I wanted to make a really personal story and not talk about societal issues as much, even though that, of course, does creep up in the drama too. But I really wanted to make a personal and a private story, a story that, you know, was kept between very few people, an inner circle who had to figure something out by themselves and not be concerned so much with the societal image of things.
Yes, but it becomes the microcosm. It really does reflect, I think, on broader themes. I came away from this film also thinking, how much were you wondering about the idea of redemption? Because it strikes me that it's a film about that challenges our idea about the capacity people have to accept someone can change. Yeah. And this notion of redemption that perhaps it has started to become less and less present in today's society, where we kind of demonize people for something maybe they believe or something they once did, and we refuse them the possibility of redemption. You know, that to me seems to be what the film's about.
Yeah, I mean, there's this sort of stoic philosophy that says to be strict with yourself and gracious with others. And I think we've flipped that on its head. And so I think we're kind of like, you know, very soft on ourselves and very critical of others. And I think, you know, this becomes like a philosophical discussion in a way about like free will and how much we can take ownership over our impulses. You know, every human, I think, has the capacity of evil and good. And there's a lot of external forces and pressures that might push you to either direction. I come to this movie with a sort of empathetic curiosity and trying to understand. And I go to some darker places and trying to, you know, find maybe some lightness, some humor, some banality in it. The movie is a conversation starter. You know, I don't have the answers. I don't try to like prescribe ethical norms, but I definitely do like to explore those themes. And I think, the movie definitely should, you know, start a discussion or two.
I guarantee it will start discussions between people who see it together. Absolutely. I mean, I think that what's also interesting about the two performances, and hopefully I'm not giving anything away here, but Zendaya's performance, her character becomes progressively cooler, like, I don't know, more self-possessed almost, despite everything spiraling out of control, really, in many ways. And his character becomes progressively more, I think there's a patheticness that comes into it. And I'm wondering if that's maybe because he is so, there's something pathetic about the way that he can't really decide what he thinks about this situation. And it's very cowardly almost.
Yeah, I mean, I think he's an overthinker and he might be a bit neurotic. I think he is very mindful of sort of, I guess, the public Overton window of what's acceptable morally. But he's dealing with a story he can't share. He can't like tell people about it or ask, what do you think about this thing? So he has to struggle with it alone. And I think that's, you go into his head a lot in the movie. I tried to like explore the phenomenology of overthinking and visually go into that mindset.
Especially the way you cut as well, I should say. I wanted to ask you about that. The way you cut and evoke subjectivity in the film is great.
Yeah, and it really is about how I feel life is lived, that at least half of my day-to-day experience is actually in my head more than in my physical presence. And I wanted to capture that. I've tried to like capture that in all my movies, and this one maybe more so than the previous ones, that experience of the sort of blurry lines of like our physical surroundings and what we're feeling in the moment, and cutting back and forth between the two sort of, the subjective and the objective. And that's like an exciting place for the camera to go that I feel is like a little bit underutilized, and I find like great joy in it.
Yeah, to the point where sometimes we don't actually, as an audience at first, know if we're seeing reality or seeing subjective reality. And then within a few seconds, usually within we realize the cut has transported us either back to the outside world or we're in the head. Mm.
Exactly, yeah. And also sometimes you don't know which head you're in, and which is also like something that as the author of this, I'm also not really sure of at times.
Filmmaker Christopher Borgli, writer-director of The Drama, which is really very good. I'm Jason DeRosso, and you're listening to The Screen Show, brought to you by ABC Radio National, which is where you need to come every week if you want to hear interviews with the best filmmakers and actors from around the world. Next, we head to Iraq, and a film set in the early 1990s, a time when every year school children were compelled to prepare an elaborate in-class celebration for the birthday of dictator Saddam Hussein. That's the backdrop to The President's Cake, a drama awarded Best First Feature at last year's Cannes that's a kind of road movie indebted to Italian neorealism about a young girl who has to make the birthday cake for her class, and how she heads out from her home with her grandmother, clutching her pet chook, to the city to buy the ingredients. The neorealist vibe unfolds as a series of vignettes, and what we get is a vivid depiction of a country teetering on the brink. There are American-led bombardments, and the economy is on its knees thanks to heavy sanctions, but life in the crowded streets continues on, almost oblivious to the geopolitical power plays. It does recall De Sica's Bicycle Thieves, this film, but talented director Hassan Hadi sprinkles his own fairy dust on this neo-neorealist project. And I don't use fairy dust lightly. I think this is, at times, an absolutely sublime film. There is a magic to it in the way that he captures landscapes and, of course, this young girl's journey. And Hassan Hadi's direction of a mostly non-professional cast is, I think, very accomplished. Hassan Hadi is coming up. Hassan Hadi, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you very much.
This is a beautiful film, and I haven't experienced watching a film for a while where I've seen sequences where I've thought, these sequences are so beautiful. And I'm referring specifically to the marshlands, which is a wonderful location in the film where the film's protagonist, this girl, the young girl, lives. And I just wanted to ask you about where they were to begin with. It's such the way you've shot these marshlands with this very still water and these very humble houses made out of lattice and bamboo and wood, and the way that they rest in the landscape is just such a graceful set of images. Where is that?
Well, you know, we shot the film fully inside Iraq, and the marshland scenes were shot in the south of Iraq on the real marshes of Iraq. It's called Chibayish. The area of it is called Chibayish, and there, you know, the lifestyle is almost the same as it used to be 7,000 years ago. It's where the legend says the story of Gilgamesh was born, you know, the first human written story and epic of Gilgamesh. And it's, there are many myths and legends about this area that, you know, you almost feel overwhelmed when you enter it. And it's a very biblical, mythical location. It was perfect for our film because it was giving us visually the tone of fableism, fable-like tone that we wanted. Because, you know, the houses that, for example, are built in the marshes are the same light, of the same style, or the same way that was built even 7,000 years ago. It felt very spontaneous to shoot the film or start our journey there because it's also where the first civilization, the Gardens of Eden, was, and to take you on a journey through Iraq. And it's also a location where Saddam tried to destroy and destroyed to a large degree. And for me, I think the film symbolizes that, how Mother Nature always triumphs over people who try to erase it.
Yeah, correct me if I'm wrong. I seem to remember that maybe in the Second Gulf War, the people who lived in this area were amongst the ones that perhaps rose up against Saddam's forces.
Yeah.
And Saddam then retaliated against them in a very brutal manner.
It is a very vast area. That's why, it was a place that people felt more safe to escape the regime and, you know, go to the marshes to escape the regime. That's why Saddam really, at the time, the solution he came up with is to dry out the marshes. And it was the biggest environmental catastrophe in history of Iraq. And he did that. He did that, I think, around 1993, 1994. It was a heaven. Like, when you visit the marshes, you really feel like you are in heaven. It's like a place that humans, animals, water are so much in symphony with each other, you know, like animals there are like, you know, coexisting with people living, you know, they're part of their upbringing in a way.
Yeah. Well, it's beautiful. Now, this film is set during the first Gulf War then?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's a fascinating look behind the curtain, I suppose, at how sanctions were affecting people on the ground in Iraq at this time. It's a fascinating look at what the regime felt like to live in.
Yeah.
And, of course, it's told from the point of view of a young girl who was on a quest. Reminded me a little bit of a kind of Bicycle Thieves, neorealist kind of quest for the ingredients to this cake. But first of all, tell me about the way you wanted to depict living under the regime at this time, because it strikes me that this is not a film that's an indictment of the regime. It is simply a portrait of a society for good and for bad. It's clearly, you know, not a very modernized society. There's a lot of corruption, but it's not an indictment. Tell me about that.
I believe when I try to make films, I'm more interested in the characters and the story of the characters and what their journey is, more than, you know, making judgments. Judgments is not for me. That's reserved for the audience. You know, they can judge the characters, they can judge, you know, the regime the way they want. For me, it was very important to avoid politics, or avoid being political in a way. That's why I did this film through a girl's perspective or children's point of view, because they are unbiased. They not politicians. They see the world how it is, like without filters. And I wanted the film to be objective, to show you the life under time that was sanctioned. Iraq was heavily sanctioned by the UN under time that Iraq was under one of the most brutal regimes, Saddam Hussein's time. And that's part of Iraq that had never been depicted on screen. And actually, it was shocking to me when I started writing this that, oh, there is no Iraqi film, or even like in a way foreign film, like or a U.S. film made about Iraq that talks about that time from this perspective. And you know, it made it even more intriguing for me.
How did you go about recreating the Iraq from this time? I mean, it's now 30 years ago, right? And I mean, you've got the cars, right? You've got the uniforms of all the different levels of authority, right? I presume. Anyway, it's very convincing. Yeah. You really do feel like you're back 30 years ago.
We really went into every single detail we could. I mean, even in the title, like the title of the film is handwritten, you know. We tried to recreate every moment, every image you see. The goal was that when you see this film, you feel like someone shot this film in the 90s under the radar and someone just found it in the warehouse, you know what I mean? And we really went to the... Even for costumes, we went to the old shops. We tried to recreate and buy whatever we found. And for the cast, even for the background actors, like people who are, you know, in the background that don't have lines, we really went to their hairstyle, their physical appearance to make sure, because, you know, people in the 90s, you know, had a different appearance, had a different physicality. And we even went into that aspect. Locations was also a big deal for us. We really tried to shoot, because we were shooting on real locations, so we tried to choose the places that needed minimum amount of production design, because, you know, we had a limited amount of resources. And we were, to a large degree, I think we were successful in recreating Iraq in 1990s. We were lucky because some of the places we shot now got completely renovated literally after we left the shoot, which is, you know, makes me happy that we were able to document part of Iraq, part of, you know, architecture, documentation, you know, for documentation for architect in Iraq.
Yeah, you got in just in time. So the urban places in Iraq or the places outside of the marshlands, those locations are in Iraq. So you were shooting in Iraq?
Everything. We shot the whole film in Iraq. We, during process of, you know, raising getting the support, raising the funds to make this film, we actually received a couple of offers from production companies to fully finance us, but on the condition to shoot the film outside Iraq. And for me, that was non-negotiable. And I would rather not to gamble and not to shoot the film over shooting this film in a different country. First, because I believe films have and stories have DNAs, they have roots, they have a feeling that, you know, you cannot really replicate that, especially with certain stories. I'm not saying all stories have to be like that, but like certain stories, really, you cannot. And this was definitely one of them, because it's not just about, I didn't just want to show you Iraq. I really wanted you to transport you to Iraq, to feel it, to smell it, to know the texture of that country, of that society. And that's what I'm hoping, you know, that audience get that from that from the experience of watching this film. And second, I really wanted to break the stigma about Iraq, that it is unsafe to shoot in Iraq. It is dangerous to shoot in Iraq. And yes, it was for a certain time, definitely. But now Iraq has progressed from that stage, and now we can shoot our films and we can tell our own stories with our own, you know, cast, actors, and crew.
How many films are made in Iraq each year?
Oh, man, it's not a lot. We don't have lots of support, but like now the government has started, for example, a grant, but, you know, we need a lot of support. I mean, if we're lucky, like it would be like 4 or 5. That's like a lot. And it's not compared. And that's why I don't believe we are in the phase of trials and errors more than, you know, establishing a whole line of that we can call Iraqi cinema.
Just to go back to the title of the film and the main focus of, well, not the focus, but the premise of the film revolves around this young girl in a classroom and the birthday of Saddam Hussein is coming up. And that's going to be a national holiday. And the teacher pretty arbitrarily orders different members of the class to to do different tasks for the special day, and the girl is asked to make a cake. And of course, she's very poor, so she has to, hence she has to go and find the ingredients for the cake. And, yeah, you know, so it's quite a saga. She goes to the city and so forth. Tell me about the tradition of the president's cake. Is it true that people made cakes or baked cakes for the birthday of Saddam Hussein?
It is true. The punishment of it depends on the teacher. So how nice or kind your teacher is. And, you know, some teachers wouldn't take any risk and they will follow the rule, report you to the, you know, authorities or something. And if that happens, then it's really a big problem going to be for you. Every year, our teacher would walk in with a ball in his hand and ask the students really to throw their names in. So he would pick the students responsible for different birthday items. For me, it was flowers or roses one day.
But so like, they were always the same items. So every national holiday to commemorate Saddam's birthday, there were each classroom in every school in Iraq had to celebrate with flowers,
like
a cake.
It would be like flowers, decorations, cleaning the class, juice, you know. It depends, but like really the big item that everybody was afraid of avoiding, it was the birthday cake.
So if your name got picked out of the bowl and you had to make the cake, you were the unlucky one. You'd gotten the short straw.
That's why I was lucky I got picked for roses or flowers, and that was not eatable. So the teachers really didn't care about that.
The teachers liked the cake aspect of it because they would eat the cake.
They would take for example, in our case, the teacher would taste the cake, say his judgment, and then wrap the cake and take it to his family. It wasn't for the students, you know. It was like for his own, you know,
enjoyment. Yeah. So there's a perk of the job being a school teacher in Saddam's Iraq, right?
I feel like there is a generation in Iraq that didn't taste birthday cake or cakes until they were 13, 14 years old into their lives. So it wasn't something at all available. Like you either eat it on Saddam's birthday in one of the celebrations or you don't eat it.
Because of the sanctions, it was so difficult to make cakes.
Sanctions was insanely heavy on Iraq. It was heavy to a degree that, you know, even pen and pencils, Iraq couldn't import. Because it was claimed that they contained a chemical substance that could be used in a chemical weapon or like making a weapon or something like that. So even for pen and pencils, it was hard to get. And at that time, flour and sugar was not allowed for Iraq to import until 1905 or 1996, something like that, when it became oil in exchange of food. Even after that, it still was difficult, and it was actually forbidden. And that's the, you know, comedy part of it, or like black comedy part of it. It actually was forbidden on people to sell flour or sugar. But at the same time, Saddam is asking people to make this cake. So it's like really a puzzle for people how to make a cake that requires materials that you actually have forbidden for us to sell or buy. You know, and that's, you know, gives you a glimpse of what life under dictatorship is. It's just there is no common sense. There's no literally logic to follow.
Yeah, I've read you talking about how you frame things. And of course, we should point out this is a beautiful widescreen film. I think you shot it beautifully. And
Thank you.
I know you have thoughts about how you frame things, how you place things together in the frame, your thoughts behind mise-en-scène, and how that represents paradoxes and tensions, societal tensions. Tell me about that.
I really like when frames, you know, just by framing, you can tell something. You can give a subtext. You can give an idea and information just by framing, just by having a background and foreground. And for me, it was very important to do that because I really had a lot to say, you know, visually. And in some scenes, you will notice we really took advantage of every location we shot in to, you know, put something to layer the story more. And for example, there is a scene, I hope when the audience watches will notice this, but like there is a scene of like we see a very old architect, a building in the background, which is called Zakurat Ur, That's one of the oldest buildings in human civilization. And it's said that, you know, Ibrahim was saved from fire and death. But in the foreground, we see this police, like the army checkpoint, where and people in caskets being transported to cemetery. You know, like the idea of death and life, you know, that paradox for me was very much important to create it in every frame, because the film is, again, is a paradoxical film. It's about making a cake, you know, but like not having access to resources to make the cake. It's about showing beauty in a time when destruction and ugliness was a lot, you know, abundant. And I try to recreate that visually through framing and subtexted with locations. Even the restaurant scene where Bibi picks Lamia is actually a restaurant where Saddam used to eat when he was young.
Oh, wow. So this is the restaurant where the grandmother takes the grandchild. And it's quite a, yes. It turns out to be quite a sinister meeting with the lady who owns the restaurant, actually. Well, it's sinister for the young girl, because she realizes that perhaps her grandmother can't look after her anymore. And this young, and this wealthy woman who runs the restaurant may be taking her in, which terrifies the girl. Yeah. So that restaurant was where Saddam used to go and eat when he was young.
Yeah, exactly.
Wow.
So for me, I mean, it may be something the audience wouldn't know, but like for me, it means something, you know, when I rewatch it or when I show it to someone, I'm like, oh, that's what I shot this set here, you know?
Yeah. And so the other location you mentioned was the Ziggurat Ur, I'm probably not pronouncing it right, but where you have that, the checkpoint scene with the coffin on top of the car. Yeah.
Yes.
You won the best debut feature at Cannes when you presented this film. So congratulations. I think you also won an audience award, but best debut feature at Cannes, The Camera Door. What did that do for you? What did you feel like when you won that?
Oh, man, it's such an honor. It's such a brilliant thing. I mean, I don't, you know, after months, I still like, you know, when I remember it, I'm overwhelmed. It's such a great honor. And, you know, to be not only the first Iraqi film, but like also to be recognized in any way is just, you know, immensely amazing. And it really, you know, opened so many doors, not only to me as an Iraqi filmmaker, but I think it allowed people, or it created interest in audience around the world to watch this film and to watch more films from Iraq. And that encourages more Iraqi artists, filmmakers to come forward, make their own stories and make their voices heard. And that's why this kind of recognitions really go much further than just, you know, where the stage is, you know, it goes beyond that. And it impacts the journey of the film, and also it impacts the journey of the country sometimes, especially a country like Iraq that really needs a lot of support to establish its cinema. I mean, it creates also certain responsibility on you, because now people have higher expectations from you in the next film. What are you going to do for the next film? And I was on the stage when Jafar Panahi was holding his palm d'or, and he looked at me and he was like, look, I won this award 30 years ago, and it was really difficult to make another film after that, but you just need to go through it and make another film and, you know, defy the expectations. Don't really, you know, overwhelm yourself with that.
What did he win it for? The White Balloon, I think, wasn't it?
I'm Googling it.
And I was just thinking, when you were talking about the 90s, I was just thinking, I know Iran is a different country, but obviously. However, you watch those 90s films from Iran and they really give you a sense of what people were like in the region, and the haircuts and
And exactly. That's a good way, because it's also a neighbor. So like we had a very similar style overall in a way. You know, but yeah, I mean, as you said, you mentioned in the beginning, it was lots of neorealism impact too in the film. And really that gives you the faith to make a film, because we made a film with non-professional actors in real locations that doesn't really have cinematic infrastructure. And my love for cinema really was born through VHS tapes, not on, you know, not in real theatrical theater. And I didn't enter theater until I was 19 or 20 or something like that.
Wow. So what really, films were you watching?
It was everything. It was like, you know, I used to be the, you know, the person to bring for one of my relatives. He would send me to this house, and I entered this house. There's a room at the end of the house, and the guy would give me, you know, some VHS tapes. And I was curious because one day, and I was started to watch, and it was a variety of films. Suddenly, I started to watch. It was Godzilla, the Japanese version, to, I don't know, Terminator, to Tarkovsky, to Italian neorealism, you know. So I just found myself captivated because that was my only window to the outside world. We were in a very, very strict regime. We didn't have any glance to what was happening, you know, in the outside Iraq. That was a deal that somehow fit the regime, like, because we were in sanctions, so there was not really any interaction, like nothing coming out from the outside world. And the regime was happy with that. So that's why we were in this, you know, bubble.
Yeah. How's the little girl, by the way? What's the impact been on the little girl who plays the protagonist?
She's great. She's doing great. But she is actually, one thing is, we haven't shown the film widely in Iraq. We were actually supposed to show it like 2 weeks ago, but then the war started. So like that's like in the region, and everybody is like, you know, because we were trying to do like a whole Middle East release. And because of the war, we were like, okay, we have to pause. So like in Iraq, they know about her, but like we haven't released the film. No one has seen her performance very much yet. So like we're very excited about that. But like, each festival she goes to, everybody wants to take a selfie with her.
Well, when the film does screen widely in the Middle East, what do you think will be the reaction, given that there's been a new outbreak of hostilities and you know, in some ways, the present reflects what's going on in this film?
I really don't know. That's why I'm really also interested, because I feel like politics creates this division between people, and it would be, I think people would have stronger reaction, whether positive or negative.
Mm.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's been great talking to you. So thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Filmmaker Hassan Hadi, do go and see The President's Cake on a big screen, soak in its atmospheres and immerse yourself in its emotion. It's a beautiful film. This is ABC Radio National's The Screen Show, an hour of conversations with filmmakers and actors, brought to you every week, hosted by me, Jason DeRosso. Okay, I want you to cast your mind back to 2024, and one of the most talked about TV shows was Baby Reindeer, starring my next guest, Jessica Gunning, who played a lonely woman living in London who starts stalking a bartender. Well, Gunning was in Sydney last week, promoting the new film adaptation of Enid Blyton's series of books, The Magic Faraway Tree. In the film, a couple played by Andrew Garfield and Claire Foy, who have three children, leave the corporate rat race and London behind to build a new life in the countryside, fixing up a dilapidated old barn and trying to establish a pasta sauce company, of all things, which is all tedious for the three kids in tow. They, however, discover something much more special, a magic tree where various fantastical creatures live. Gunning plays one of them, Dame Washalot. Fans of the books will no doubt know who this person is. I haven't read them. But this character controls a portal that leads to various strange dimensions, including a land of sweets, where moral lesson learning and puzzle solving are the order of the day. I was a great fan of Gunning in Baby Reindeer. She's not in this a whole lot, but I leapt at the chance to sit down with her.
Just remember, don't go in that wood up top. Some folks say it's enchanted. Strange creatures. Floaty lights. Just the usual things.
You say that was very usual.
Jessica Gunning, welcome to The Screen Show.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Did you read the books as a child?
I read The Secret Seven. I actually didn't read The Magic Faraway Tree until I was a bit older and some of my friends' kids started getting into it. So I read it then more in my adult years. But yeah, no, I was an Enid Blyton fan, but more of the Famous Five Secret Seven.
I was a Famous Five person. And also the TV series of the Famous Five I really, really liked.
I remember, yeah.
Do you remember? When you did encounter them later, what did you think of them? Because it strikes me that what's really interesting is that, they're all written around the war.
Yes.
It's an incredibly dark period where she's writing these quite fantastical books.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, I feel like it's kind of natural, I suppose, in that time to want to escape in a way. And I think this kind of world is every child's dream to escape into. So it kind of makes sense, actually, in hindsight, when you think about it. But I just love all the fantastical characters. And as you read it as an adult, you're like, what the heck was she on? But in a great way. Yeah. But yeah, it's quite, magical.
And when you walk onto the set, is it also magical? Because it seems to me that there are a lot of practical sets in this. Can you describe the main set where you are?
Yeah, the main studio set was amazing. There was actual real flowers and shrubbery as well. It felt very practical in terms of, I suppose when I first got the job, I wondered whether it would be a lot of CGI and green screen. But really the only bit of it that was green screen was the backdrop. The rest of the set was very workable, manageable. And the tree itself was all built on the sound studio stage. So it was great.
Do you enjoy working in fantasy? I mean, have you done a lot of it or, as opposed to more sort of realistic roles?
Yeah, this is probably the first thing I've done. I've got friends who've done things acting, to tennis balls and stuff. And I always thought, but I'm so glad this was all of us on the stage in real life, not having to pretend anyone wasn't there or, it felt very collaborative. It felt almost like a play in a way and everything was usable and, yeah.
How would you describe your character? Because she's kind of, I don't know, she has control over this magical portal kind of thing.
Yeah, Dame Washlot's platform is kind of the launch pad for all of the lands that are at the top of the faraway tree. So I suppose she is the person that sees them come and go. In a way, is a kind of safety net for the children to feel like they can be brave and go off to all these magical places and come back to that platform as a safe space. And she just kind of is the master of the changing of the lands, really, which is, it's nice.
Well, what are the themes in your mind explored in this film? I mean, obviously it's a family film. It has this whole aspect of the children travelling through this portal to these wonderful, fantastical dimensions.
Yeah. Well, obviously you've got the element of technology in this modern age, and the family that we meet at the beginning of the movie are very much in that world. Andrew Garfield's character's got invented the scratchel, which is like a screen satchel where the kids put all of their devices. And I think it's about not necessarily saying no to technology, but more like yes to adventure. So it's this kind of portal into childhood imagination and bringing those children together and the family back together really by the end of the movie.
Is the childhood that's depicted in this film something you can relate to? I mean, growing up, I don't want to sort of make any guesses about exactly how old you are, but I don't assume you grew up with smartphones and so forth.
No, I'm from a little village in Yorkshire, so I can very much relate to when I was younger playing with my brother and sister all day in like local fields and things and then coming back at night. So I suppose in that way, Dame Washlot, in a sense, is that kind of ladder up to going off and playing and letting those children have a bit of risk and be free in all these different lands. And I suppose I had that when I was younger. We just kind of, they'd shout us all back and we'd come back in for tea. So it's a very different time when I grew up, yeah.
Does coming from a village in Yorkshire make you the actor you are today, do you think?
I think so, maybe. I've always wanted to be an actor. My mum worked at the local school as a drama teacher, so I always used to go and watch the kids do school plays at the weekend. And in my mind, they were just like the coolest people around rehearsing on a Sunday, these plays. And so I suppose I've always really been into drama in that way and always wanted to be an actor. But
Did anything prepare you for this sort of, I mean, you've worked a lot, but you had this stratospheric sudden shot into the universe where suddenly you were someone recognisable around the world for the role in Baby Reindeer. Did anything prepare you at all for the success that you had with that role in Baby Reindeer?
I don't think any of us were really prepared for it. When I read the scripts, I knew it was going to be quite a special project to be part of, but I don't think any of us really thought it would become what it was. And the amount of people that connected with it and watched it was just, I can't really compute the numbers really. So yeah.
Why do people connect with it, do you think, and your character in particular, both for good and for bad, I suppose?
I think the way that Richard wrote the script was in a very honest way. And I think it showed that people were ready to watch hard things. They don't necessarily need everything tied up neatly with a bow. And I think because it was so honest, people connected to that, I think, in a way. And I think that I just think he was amazing with how he was so brave in telling the story, really. And that really got to people, I think, yeah.
Did you like the character? How did you? Because, you know, to me, I think you played her with quite a lot of empathy.
Yeah, thanks.
And at times she was appeared to be this monster, but the perspective of the show subtly shifted, I think. And sometimes you'd think, well, this is a lonely person.
Yeah, and I never saw her as a monster. I saw her as like a lost person, really. But he was too, you know, Donnie, Richard's character. And I think they found each other at a time in their life when they both needed to be seen in different ways. And I never kind of thought of her as like the villain. I suppose I always understood the logic of why she felt connected to him, even if it was half in her fantasy. I still always got her, you know. Even when I read it, I remember doing a scene with my friend practicing for one of the auditions, and I said, oh, this bit is like the most romantic scene ever, and it's the bit where she says she wants to zip him open and climb inside. My friend was like, romantic? I was like, yeah. And it really like dawned on me that I was like, oh, no, I see this as like a love story. And I think that for her, it is, you know, so maybe that was good in a way.
What effect did it have on your career? Because, I mean, you won awards for it. There was so much acclaim. Recently, you've worked with Steven Soderbergh, but, you know, you've done stage and screen. How do you describe the effect it had?
I think it's just meant that more people know who I am, and I've had the opportunity to, like you say, work with some amazing people since and meet some really interesting people as well, especially over in the States. I've never filmed or worked over there yet. So it just meant that I was able to go over and be introduced to some incredible filmmakers and people in general, which I don't think I would have had the opportunity to if I didn't do Baby Reindeer, yeah.
Jessica Gunning, who stars in The Magic Faraway Tree, a film with a lot of colour, a lot of nice practical sets. I will say, though, that director Ben Gregor falls short of delivering something as strange as Willy Wonka, the original, I mean, or the teenage operatic drama of a Harry Potter film. This is a well-meaning, very gentle, bordering on anodyne adventure movie that I think is best for younger kids. I don't think it would entertain children much older than 12. All right, that's The Magic Faraway Tree. I'm Jason DeRosso. Time for me to go far away. Until next time, thanks to producer Sarah Corbett and to the current arts manager at ABC Radio National, Sarah Lestrange. See you next time.